Welcome, dear listeners, to Nocturnal Tales, where the night's shadows whisper secrets long buried. Tonight, we beckon you into the desolate halls of Lower Cranston, a remote estate shrouded in fog and fear. Written in the style of the inimitable Arthur Conan Doyle, The Curse of the Ebony Spear plunges you into a world where a storm howls beyond the walls, yet a darker tempest festers within. A cursed spear, a locked room murder, and a tangle of secrets poised to unravel. Sherlock Holmes, that maestro of deduction, steps forth to pierce the fog of deceit. But before we step into this labyrinth of suspense, I must ask a small favor. If this tale of mystery stirs your curiosity, consider subscribing to our Nocturnal Circle and dropping a comment below to share where in the world you're listening from tonight. Now settle in, dim the lights, and let the shadows speak. Chapter 1. A Late Night Visitor. It is a peculiar truth often noted in these humble records that the most remarkable of Sherlock Holmes's investigations commence not amidst the bustle of day, but in the stillness of night, stealing upon us like shadows cast by a flickering lamp. So it was upon a dismal November evening in 1892, when a fog, thick and oppressive, descended upon London, cloaking the city in a damp, creeping pall. The gas lamps along Baker Street glimmered feebly, their light devoured by the mist, and the air bore the sharp bite of winter's approach. I had been nodding over a medical journal, the fire in our grate reduced to embers, when the shrill peal of our bell pierced the silence and jolted me awake. Holmes, ever attuned to the whisper of adventure, rose swiftly from his chair, his gaunt silhouette framed against the hearth's dying glow. His sharp grey eyes sparkled with that restless energy I knew so well, the harbinger of a puzzle worth his mettle. "Watson," he remarked, his tone cool and deliberate, "we are about to entertain a guest whose urgency, I wager, exceeds the hour." Descending the stairs, I opened the door to reveal a figure standing just beyond the reach of our hall lamp's one light. He was a tall man, though his posture sagged as if burdened by some unseen load. His overcoat hung heavy with rain, its hem dripping upon the step, and his hat brim wept with the night's moisture. His face, pale and haggard, bore the marks of sleepless torment, and his eyes, wild and hollow, flickered with a nervous intensity as he gripped a small valise. "I beg your pardon for this intrusion at so late an hour," he said, his voice trembling with exhaustion and fear. "I must speak with Dr. Watson or Mr. Sherlock Holmes." "You address Dr. John Watson," I replied, ushering him inside. "Come, warm yourself by the fire." He hesitated, then stepped across the threshold, with the air of a man unsure of sanctuary. I provided a towel and settled him near the hearth, while Holmes, ensconced in his armchair, observed him with quiet, piercing scrutiny. The stranger wiped his face, his hands unsteady, and after a moment's pause he spoke. "My name is Wilfred Colby," he began, his words faltering. "Clerk and assistant to the late Professor Alistair Milbank of Lower Cranston, Sussex. 2 nights past, the professor was found dead in his study." The room grew still, save for the faint patter of rain against the panes and the ragged rhythm of Colby's breath. Holmes leaned forward, his fingertips pressed together in that familiar gesture of concentration. "Proceed," he said, his voice a steady beacon amid the man's turmoil. "Relate the circumstances of this discovery." Colby swallowed hard, his pallor deepening. It was Mrs. Farham, the housekeeper, who came upon him. She heard a commotion in the night, a struggle, she claimed, and upon entering the study found him sprawled upon the floor, his face frozen in terror, his hands clasped about a spear of black ebony. They could scarcely pry it from his grasp. I glanced at Holmes, catching the subtle twitch of his lips, a sign that this detail had ignited his curiosity. "This spear," he inquired, his tone soft yet insistent, "is it of particular significance?" So it seems, Colby murmured, his voice sinking to a near whisper, as though fearful of being overheard. The professor returned from Africa some months ago, bearing a trove of artifacts. Among them was this spear which he prized above all, an object, he said, steeped in a curse. Though I pride myself a rational man, a chill crept up my spine. Holmes, however, remained unmoved, his gaze unwavering.
"No evidence of intrusion, I presume?" he asked. "No shattered locks? No tracks in the dust?"
"None reported," Colby answered, shaking his head. "The doors were bolted, the windows secure. The household is gripped by panic. Some whisper that the spear itself dealt the blow, though I dismiss such folly. Yet the dread persists, and I cannot abide it unresolved." Holmes's eyes narrowed, a gleam of thought behind them. "You spoke of the professor's travels. Did he mention any quarrels over these relics, perhaps with competitors or foes met abroad?" Colby nodded, his grip tightening on the towel. "There was Colonel Alleron, a rival collector of African curiosities. They clashed fiercely over the spear's provenance not long before this tragedy. The professor maintained it was his by right, but he confided little else. I suspect there is more to uncover." Rising, Holmes retrieved his pipe from the mantel and filled it with deliberate care. "Have you anything tangible to illuminate this matter?" he asked. Colby reached into his valise and withdrew a thin bundle of papers, their edges frayed and smudged. "These are the professor's notes," he said, offering them to Holmes. "I took them from his desk ere the police arrived, hoping they might yield some insight." Holmes unfolded the sheets and perused them with his customary swiftness, his brow furrowing slightly. "Mentions of the Night Whisper tribe," he murmured, almost to himself, "and a caution of a curse upon those who profane their sacred relics. Most curious." He tapped a line with his finger, then set the papers aside. "What precisely do you ask of us, Mr. Colby?"
"Clarity," Colby replied, his voice earnest, "and protection for those at Lower Cranston. The household fears another calamity."
Holmes struck a match, its flare briefly illuminating his hawk-like features. "Very well," he said at last, exhaling a curl of smoke. "We shall take the first train to Sussex tomorrow. For now, rest here. Mrs. Hudson will arrange a room." Relief softened Colby's strained expression. "I feared you might refuse me," he said, gratitude evident in his tone.
"Hardly,"
Holmes replied, a faint smile playing upon his lips. "The hour may be late, but the chase, I sense, is just begun. Superstition often cloaks the deeds of men, and I mean to strip it bare." As I led Colby to the guest room, I noted the lightening of his step, as if a weight had been halved. Returning to the sitting room, I found Holmes at the window, hands clasped behind him, peering into the swirling fog. "A cursed spear, a sealed chamber, a lifeless scholar," he mused, his voice a whisper. "And that phrase, it knows. Take heed, Watson. We tread a shadowed path." Chapter 2. The Moorland Shadows. The first light of dawn crept over London as we boarded the early train for Sussex, bound for the remote estate of Lower Cranston. Wilfred Colby, still pale and shaken from the events of the previous night, sat hunched in his corner of the carriage, his eyes darting anxiously at every station we passed. Holmes, by contrast, was a picture of quiet concentration, his sharp features set in that familiar mask of contemplation as he perused a small leather-bound volume on African tribal customs, a text Colby had brought from the late Professor Milbank's library. I, for my part, attempted to occupy myself with a medical journal, though my thoughts strayed more often than not to the grim mystery awaiting us. As the train rattled southward, the lively bustle of London's outskirts gave way to rolling fields and patches of sparse woodland. The sky, overcast and heavy with the promise of rain, cast a pall over the landscape, and a chill wind swept through the carriage whenever the door was opened. Yet it was not until we reached the edge of the moorland
that the true desolation of our destination began to impress itself upon me. The moors stretched out like a vast, undulating sea of fog-shrouded hills, their bleak expanse broken only by twisted, wind-bent trees and the occasional outcrop of jagged rock. The air grew colder, sharper, carrying with it the scent of damp earth and decay, and I could not shake the sense that we were venturing into a place forsaken by both man and reason. Lower Cranston itself emerged from the mist like a spectral vision. A stern grey stone manor perched atop a rise, its ivy-clad walls looming over the wild grounds below. The estate was encircled by a low stone wall, half crumbled in places, and beyond it the moorland stretched endlessly, its fog curling like a living thing among the gorse and heather. The wind, which had been a mere whisper in London, now keened across the open heath, its mournful cry echoing through the barren trees. There was a stillness to the place, a watchful hush, as though the manor and the moor alike held their breath, waiting for some unseen calamity. We alighted from the hansom at the foot of a gravel drive, the crunch of our boots unnaturally loud in the oppressive quiet. Colby led the way up the wide front steps, his shoulders hunched against the wind, and as we crossed the threshold into the manor's shadowed hall, I felt the weight of the place settle upon me like a shroud. The air inside was thick with the scent of old wood and leather, mingled with the faint exotic tang of foreign spices, remnants, no doubt, of the professor's African expeditions. The hall was adorned with a curious mixture of European antiques and tribal relics. Spears, masks, and shields hung upon the walls, their dark, carved faces staring out with an almost accusatory gaze. Andrews, the elderly butler, greeted us with a bow, his lined face betraying the strain the household had endured. "Mr. Holmes, Dr. Watson," he intoned, his voice hushed as though in deference to the manor's oppressive silence. "Mrs. Farham, the housekeeper, awaits you in the study. This way, if you please." We followed him down a corridor lined with ancestral portraits, their stern visages seeming to track our progress with disapproval. The servants we passed moved with hurried steps, their glances wary and fleeting, as though they feared to linger too long in any one place. Holmes, ever observant, drank in every detail, the scuff of a boot on the carpet, the faint tremor in a maid's hand as she polished a banister, his mind already sifting through the subtle threads of the mystery. At the end of the corridor, Andrews rapped gently on a heavy oak door before ushering us into the study. It was a cavernous room, its walls lined from floor to ceiling with bookcases, the air thick with the must of old parchment and leather. A broad desk stood at the center, its surface neatly ordered, though certain spaces suggested that items had been removed, likely the notes Colby had salvaged. Two high-backed chairs faced a cold hearth, and in one of them sat Mrs. Farham, a woman of middle years whose careworn features spoke of both grief and steadfast duty. She rose as we entered, curtsying lightly. "Good morning, gentlemen," she said, her voice soft but steady. "Thank you for coming. I fear the household is quite undone by recent events." Holmes inclined his head. "We are here to bring clarity, madam. Pray, recount for us the night of Professor Milbank's death. Omit no detail, however trivial." Mrs. Farham's hands trembled slightly as she clasped them before her. "It was 2 nights ago, sir. I was in my quarters when I heard a commotion from the corridor. A cry, sharp and sudden, followed by a dreadful scuffle. I hesitated, for the professor disliked intrusion. But the noise was so alarming that I ventured to the study. When I opened the door..." She paused, swallowing hard. "He lay upon the floor, his eyes wide with terror, clutching that ebony spear. His face was contorted, as though he had seen something unspeakable. I called for help, but by the time the staff arrived, he was gone." "And the spear?" Holmes pressed. "Had you seen it in his possession before?" "Never, sir," she replied. "It was kept in the artifact room under lock and key. How it came to be in his hand, I cannot say. The staff whisper that it moved of its own accord, but I—" She faltered, her composure slipping. I am a woman of faith, Mr. Holmes, but I confess, the sight chilled me to the bone. Holmes's gaze softened, though his tone remained firm. Fear not, Mrs. Farham. We shall uncover the truth. Now, were there any signs of intrusion? Footprints, broken locks?
None, sir, she said, shaking her head. The study was locked from within, and the windows were secure. It was as if the spear had appeared from the ether.
I exchanged a glance with Holmes, noting the faint twitch at the corner of his mouth, a sign that he had already dismissed the supernatural in favor of a more earthly explanation. He moved to the desk, his keen eyes scanning its surface before turning to the hearth, where a half-burned log lay cold in the grate. Crouching, he examined faint smudges of soot along the edge, then rose to inspect the window. The latch bore subtle scratches as though it had been tampered with, though not recently.
"Curious," he murmured, running a fingertip over the metal. "These marks are not fresh, perhaps from an earlier attempt. But on the night in question, no breach occurred."
He turned back to Mrs. Farham.
"The spear now?"
"It was returned by the constable," she said, her voice dropping. "He saw no reason to keep it, though I wish he had. It's back in its case, locked away, but the staff, they fear it still."
"Take us there," Holmes said.
We followed her to an adjacent chamber, a private museum of sorts, where the professor's passion for African lore was evident. Masks with hollow eyes, beaded garments, and clay vessels lined the shelves, but at the center, beneath a glass case, lay the ebony spear. 4 feet of polished darkness, its shaft etched with intricate tribal runes, it seemed to drink in the light, casting an almost palpable chill. I could not help but feel a faint unease as I gazed upon it, though I chided myself for such foolishness.
Holmes, however, approached it with clinical detachment, his eyes tracing the carvings. "A remarkable artifact," he said, "though its power lies in the minds of men, not in the wood itself." He glanced at Colby. "You hold the only key?"
"Yes," Colby affirmed, producing it from his pocket.
"None here would dare touch it. Fear holds them captive."
"Fear is often the handmaiden of ignorance," Holmes replied, his tone gentle but firm. "We shall see what truth lies behind this legend."
As we returned to the study, a timid knock interrupted us. A young maid, her apron twisted in nervous hands, curtsied awkwardly.
"Begging your pardon, Mrs. Farham, but Betty saw something in the yard last night, a figure cloaked and tall, holding something long like a spear. It vanished into the mist."
Mrs. Farham's face tightened. "The staff are beside themselves, Mr. Holmes. They say the moor is cursed, that the spear's shadow walks among us."
Holmes's brow furrowed.
"Describe the moorland beyond, Mrs. Farham."
She shivered. "A forsaken place, sir. Mists roll in thick as soup, and the wind howls like a banshee. The locals say it's haunted by those who lost their way. Since the professor's death, it feels alive watching us."
Later, as we stood alone in the study, I ventured, "Alleran, perhaps, skulking about."
"Possibly," Holmes mused, his gaze distant.
"But this moor hides more than one man's secrets. We must tread carefully, Watson. There are shadows here deeper than any curse."
Chapter 3. Whispers in the Night.
The night settled over Lower Cranston like a heavy shroud, the moor outside swallowed by a thick, clammy fog that pressed against the manor's windows. The wind wailed mournfully through the ancient eaves, a sound that seemed to carry secrets older than the stones themselves. Inside, the oppressive hush was palpable, broken only by the creak of settling wood. It was in this eerie stillness that Sherlock Holmes proposed a vigil, a watch to pierce the mystery shrouding the ebony spear.
"We must stay awake tonight, Watson," Holmes said, his voice low but firm as he tapped a forefinger against the study's mantel. "The intruder who breached this house will not risk the light of day. Darkness is their ally, and we must meet them there."
I nodded, though my nerves buzzed with unease. And if they come?
We'll be ready, he replied, his calm slicing through my tension. But we must be unseen. Silence is our shield.
Mr. Wilfred Colby, his face etched with worry, offered to join us, but Holmes declined.
Your willingness is noted, but this requires a subtlety you cannot afford. Watson and I have weathered such shadows before.
Dinner passed in strained quiet, the staff's anxious glances following us as we left the table. When the house seemed to settle, Holmes and I slipped into position, an alcove off the corridor leading to Professor Milbank's study. Concealed behind a tapestry bearing a faded family crest, we peered through a narrow slit into the dimly lit hallway. A single lamp flickered at the far end, its light casting restless shadows that twisted like spectres across the walls. Time dragged in that cramped space. Holmes stood motionless, his sharp eyes fixed on the corridor, while I fought the urge to shift, my foot tingling from stillness. The air thrummed with unspoken tension, a sense that we were not alone, that something watched from the gloom. Then, as the hall clock struck one, a sound pierced the silence, a low murmur, like voices hushed in a rhythm too faint to grasp. It rose and fell, more chant than speech, eerie in its cadence. Holmes's hand steadied me with a light grip on my shoulder, urging me to hold. A faint light appeared at the corridor's end, wavering as if carried by an unsteady hand. The chanting ceased, replaced by hurried whispers. My pulse raced as a figure emerged, tall, cloaked, its face lost to shadow. In its hand gleamed a slender object, the ebony spear. It paused at the study door, testing the knob, which held fast, locked by our earlier efforts. The figure hesitated, a second rush of whispers hinting at another presence just beyond the light. Two intruders, perhaps. The thought chilled me. Finding the door barred, the figure turned, retreating into the dark as the light snuffed out. Holmes exhaled quietly, signaling patience. We waited, the silence stretching taut, but no further movement came. An hour crept by, my nerves fraying, when a scream shattered the night. A woman's cry, sharp with terror. Holmes flung the tapestry aside and we rushed into the corridor, only to halt at the sight before us. The study door stood ajar, though I'd have sworn it was secure. More unsettling, the ebony spear lay in the hallway's center, its dark wood stark against the pale floor, fresh blood glistening on its tip. My stomach twisted as Holmes knelt, lifting the spear with care. "Violence, Watson," he murmured, his gray eyes narrowing. "Yet this blood, it's a deception, likely animal blood or from a minor cut, smeared to sow dread." He glanced toward the artifact room nearby. "See these faint scratches on the case lock? Our intruder is resourceful. Either they possess a duplicate key or skill with a pick." Mrs. Farham stumbled into view, her face drained of color. "Mr. Holmes, Dr. Watson, please, there's blood upstairs and Lucy's gone." We followed her frantic lead to the upper floor, where a small pool of blood stained the boards near the banister, smears trailing as if something or someone had been dragged. My heart sank as I met Holmes's grim stare. Servants gathered, their whispers rising in fear. "She's taken," one muttered. "The curse has her." Holmes crouched, studying the blood. "A few drops, a gap, then more. The victim was carried, not walking." He traced the trail to a side passage ending at a locked storeroom. "The key," he commanded, and Mrs. Farham hurried to retrieve it. The storeroom, once opened, was a scene of disorder. Linens toppled, a lamp shattered, scuff marks scarring the floor. A side door hung ajar, revealing a back stairwell. "Their escape," Holmes said tightly. "But why Lucy? What purpose does she serve?" Mrs. Farham wrung her hands, trembling. "She's 16, Milbank's niece, sharp-witted but scornful of the staff's tales. She laughed at their cursed nonsense. Please, save her."
"We will," Holmes assured her,
securing the spear and posting guards. Fear not. Reason will prevail.
Back in the study, Holmes pored over Milbank's diaries, his brow furrowed. Warnings of the Night Whisper curse, he mused, yet no wounds on his body. A human hand hides behind this myth, Watson. I nodded, though doubt lingered. The blood, the spear's strange movements, could it all be mere trickery? Holmes caught my uncertainty and offered a faint smile. The moor keeps its riddles close, but we'll unravel them yet.
Chapter 4. The Depths Below.
The first grey light of dawn crept over the moor, its pale fingers slipping through the fog to cast a wan glow upon Lower Cranston. Yet the lifting mist brought no comfort, only a sharper chill and the oppressive weight of the unknown. Lucy's disappearance hung over the manor like a spectre, and the staff's whispers of curses and vengeful spirits grew bolder with each passing hour. Even I, a man of medicine and reason, could not wholly dismiss the creeping dread that had taken root in my chest. But Sherlock Holmes, ever the bastion of logic, remained unmoved by the manor's gloom, his keen mind already sifting through the tangled threads of the mystery. "We must act swiftly, Watson," he said, his voice low but resolute as we stood in the study, the ebony spear once more locked behind glass. "Lucy's life may depend on it. The intruder's trail is still fresh. There are clues yet to be uncovered." I nodded, though my heart was heavy. "Where do we begin, the storeroom?"
"Precisely," Holmes replied. "Let us return there. In the chaos of last night, we may have missed something vital."
We descended to the upper floor, where the storeroom's side door still hung ajar, a silent witness to the violence that had transpired. The air was thick with the scent of dust and linseed oil, and the faint metallic tang of blood lingered like a grim reminder. Holmes knelt by the threshold, his keen eyes scanning the floorboards. He traced a finger along the scuff marks, noting their direction and depth. "Observe, Watson," he said, gesturing to a series of shallow grooves. "These were made by boots, likely a man's, given the size. The pattern suggests haste. A struggle, perhaps, as Lucy was dragged through here." I crouched beside him, my gaze following the trail. "And these?" I pointed to a set of smaller, fainter marks.
"Lucy's slippers," Holmes confirmed. "She resisted, but her strength was no match. The intruder was deliberate. He knew this passage well."
My brow furrowed.
"A servant, perhaps? Or someone familiar with the manor's layout?"
"Possibly," Holmes mused, rising to his feet. "But we must not leap to conclusions. Let us see where this trail leads." We followed the marks down the back stairwell, a narrow, winding passage used by the staff to move discreetly between floors. The air grew colder as we descended, the walls damp with condensation, and I could not shake the feeling that we were venturing into the bowels of some ancient, forgotten place. At the foot of the stairs, the trail veered sharply into a warren of disused storerooms and wine cellars, their shelves thick with dust and cobwebs. Holmes's lantern cut through the gloom, illuminating a corridor that ended in a stout wooden door, its iron bolt rusted but intact. He tested it, and with a groan, the bolt slid free. Beyond lay a pitch-black passage, its rough stone walls slick with moisture, the stench of stagnant air curling around us like a shroud.
"An old smuggler's tunnel, perhaps," I ventured, my voice echoing softly.
"Or a remnant of the manor's medieval foundations," Holmes replied, his tone thoughtful. "Lower Cranston is built atop older structures. There may be a network of passages beneath us." We pressed on, the lantern's beam revealing a scattering of debris, broken crates, rotted sacks of grain, and the faint glint of rusted tools. But beneath the clutter, Holmes's sharp eyes caught something more telling, footprints in the dust, muddled but distinct.
"Two sets," he murmured, kneeling to examine them.
"One large, one small. Lucy's, I'd wager. The larger prints are deep, deliberate. Our intruder was no phantom, Watson, but a man of flesh and blood."
I exhaled. relieved to anchor the mystery in the tangible. But where do they lead?
Holmes traced the prints to a narrow archway, half concealed by a collapsed beam. We squeezed through, emerging into a circular chamber with a low, vaulted ceiling. The walls were etched with faded carvings. Some bore the heraldry of long-dead families. Others depicted tribal patterns eerily similar to those on the ebony spear. My breath caught as I recognized the swirling runes.
"Holmes," I whispered, "these markings, they're identical to the spears."
He nodded, his expression unreadable. The professor was no mere collector, Watson. He sought to marry local legends with those of the Night Whisper tribe, likely to debunk the curse through scholarly rigor. His mind was one of reason, not superstition. I frowned, considering the implications.
"But how did these tribal carvings come to be here, Holmes, in a Sussex manor, of all places?"
Holmes traced a finger over a faded rune, his voice low.
"These carvings predate Milbank, Watson. They were likely etched by an ancestor of the manor's owners, a traveler or explorer who ventured to Africa centuries ago and returned with artifacts and a fascination for the Night Whisper tribe's culture. This chamber must have been their private study, a place to house their collection and delve into the mysteries they brought back. Milbank, in his time, rediscovered it and saw the connection, a link between the manor's history and the tribe's myths."
I exhaled slowly, the weight of the manor's hidden past settling upon me.
"So he aimed to disprove the curse by studying its origins?"
"Precisely," Holmes said. "He was a man of science, fascinated by the overlap between folklore and fact. But his curiosity, it seems, led him to a perilous path."
Before I could reply, a faint scratching echoed from beyond the chamber. Holmes's hand shot up, signaling silence. We crept forward, the sound growing louder, a rhythmic scrape, like metal on stone. My pulse quickened, and I tightened my grip on my revolver.
The noise led us to a spiral staircase carved into the rock, its steps worn smooth by time. The air grew colder still, the walls slick with seepage, and a sense of claustrophobia pressed in as we descended. At the stair's base, a cramped hallway stretched into shadow, and there, behind a heavy door, came a muffled thump. Holmes pressed his ear to the wood, his brow furrowed.
"Voices," he whispered, "faint but distinct."
I strained to listen, catching only a low murmur punctuated by a soft moan. Holmes tested the latch it held fast. With a shared glance, we pushed against the door, its hinges groaning as it yielded. The cell beyond was small, its air stale and thick. Our lanterns flared, revealing Lucy huddled on the floor, her wrists bound with coarse rope. Her eyes widened in terror, then flooded with relief as she recognized us.
"Dr. Watson, Mr. Holmes!" she gasped, her voice hoarse.
I rushed to her side, cutting the bindings with my pocket knife. She clung to me, trembling violently.
"They took me, two men, one cloaked, the other masked. They spoke of the spear, of its power. They wanted the amulet from my uncle's trunk."
Holmes's eyes narrowed.
"The amulet? What did they say of it?"
Lucy shuddered.
"They called it a key to awaken the spear's curse. They were furious when I told them I didn't know where it was."
Holmes exchanged a glance with me, his mind racing.
"Your uncle kept it hidden, no doubt.
But why Lucy? Why target you?"
She shook her head, tears brimming. "I mocked their superstitions, said the spear was just wood and tails. They laughed, said I'd learn its truth soon enough."
A chill crept up my spine, but Holmes's voice remained steady.
"You're safe now, Lucy. We'll see you back to the manor."
As we helped her to her feet, a faint echo drifted from the stairwell, footsteps swift and deliberate. Holmes's hand tightened on his lantern.
"They've returned. We must move quickly."
We hastened up the spiral steps, Lucy's weight slowing our pace, the footsteps growing louder behind us. My heart pounded with each turn,
the narrow passage seeming to close in. At last, we emerged into the cellar, but the relief was short-lived. A shadow flitted at the corridor's end, vanishing into the dark. Holmes's jaw set.
They know we've found her. The game is afoot, Watson.
Chapter 5. The Moorland Hunt. The storm that had loomed all day unleashed its wrath as Sherlock Holmes and I emerged from the shadowy depths of Lower Cranston, escorting a trembling but unharmed Lucy. Rain battered the ancient walls of the manor, and the wind wailed across the moor, its eerie howl blending with the distant growl of thunder. A thick fog blanketed the ground, swirling in ghostly tendrils that softened our footsteps as we hastened Lucy back to the house. Even as we stepped inside, Holmes's mind was already leaping ahead, assembling the puzzle's scattered pieces. "The amulet," he muttered, his voice nearly lost in the storm's roar. "It is the linchpin, tying the spear's legend to our adversary's intent. Lucy's captors crave it, and they will not relent until it is theirs." I frowned, puzzled. "But why? What do they think it does?" Holmes's eyes sparked with keen focus. "The Night Whisper tribe's curse, Watson. They believe the amulet unlocks the spear's fabled power, a power they mean to harness. We must secure it first." We entrusted Lucy to Mrs. Farham, who bustled her off with comforting words and a warm blanket. Holmes turned to Mr. Colby, his tone brisk. "The amulet. Where did the professor store it?" Colby twisted his hands, his face ashen. "In his private trunk, locked in his bedchamber. But it's been disturbed. I checked this morning. The trunk was tampered with, though the lock held." Holmes's jaw clenched. "Then our enemy has yet to triumph. We must retrieve it now." We climbed to the professor's chamber, a somber room of dark wood and thick curtains, heavy with the musty scent of age and secrets. An iron-banded trunk sat at the bed's foot, its lock marred by scratches but unbroken. With a slim pick from his pocket, Holmes deftly opened it, the lid groaning in protest. Within lay a clutter of journals, sketches, and relics, clay statuettes, beaded strands, and a small cloth pouch. Holmes untied its strings, revealing a wooden amulet, dark and intricately carved with swirling runes matching those on the ebony spear. He examined it closely, his expression pensive. "A talisman," he said, "tied to the spear's myth. The professor likely understood its value. Perhaps he aimed to keep it from dangerous hands." I studied the amulet, its etching seeming to shift in the faint light. "And now our foe wants it to fulfill their ritual."
"Exactly," Holmes replied, "but we shall thwart them. We'll use the amulet to lure them out." My heart raced.
"A trap!" Holmes's lips twitched in a rare smile.
"Indeed, Watson. Tonight we wait. If our quarry is as desperate as I suspect, they will come." We spent the next hours setting our ambush. Holmes positioned himself in the professor's chamber, the amulet placed prominently on the desk, while I hid behind a bulky wardrobe, revolver in hand. The storm raged outside, lightning slashing through the dark in fleeting bursts, casting eerie shadows across the room. Midnight passed, the manor steeped in stillness save for the wind's mournful cries. My nerves stretched tight, every floorboard's creak jolting me alert. Then, as the clock tolled two, a soft scrape sounded from the corridor, a cautious footfall on stone. Holmes's gaze met mine, a finger to his lips. The door handle turned and the door eased open, admitting a shadowy figure. It glided forward with a hunter's stealth, eyes locked on the amulet. As it reached for the desk, Holmes leapt up, his voice slicing through the gloom. "Colonel Alleron, I presume?" The figure stiffened, then pivoted, its hood slipping to reveal the colonel's gaunt, feverish face. His eyes burned with rage and desperation, a thin blade gleaming in his grip. "You interfering wretch," he snarled, "you cannot halt what's begun. The spear's power belongs to me." Holmes remained unruffled, his stare icy. "There is no power, Colonel," only madness. The spear is mere wood and fable, warped by your obsession.
Alaran's laugh grated like broken glass. Mad? The Night Whisper's curse is real. I've witnessed it. Milbank scorned it, and it took him. With the amulet, I'll command its strength.
He lunged for the desk, but Holmes seized his wrist, wrenching the blade free. Alaran thrashed, his frenzy lending him force, and I emerged, revolver leveled, only to meet his wild glare.
"Fire, and the curse claims you too," he spat.
With a swift twist, Holmes flung Alaran to the floor, pinning him. "There is no curse, only your malice. Admit it, Colonel, Milbank's death was your work."
Alaran's face twisted in fury.
"He stole the spear from me. It was mine, and he paid for it. The spear felled him, as it will you."
Holmes's hold tightened. "You poisoned him, didn't you? A toxin on the spear's tip, subtle and traceless."
Alaron's defiance wavered, his breathing ragged.
"Yes, a native venom, quick and silent. He gripped the spear as he died, cementing the tale. But the amulet, it's the key to true power. With it I can—"
"You can do nothing," Holmes cut in, voice frigid. "The amulet is a bauble, its power a fantasy. Your accomplice, the masked man. Where is he?"
Alaron's gaze flicked to the window where a shadow darted past.
"Too late, Holmes. He's on the moor, readying the ritual. The curse will rise and you're powerless."
With a surge of strength, Alaron broke free, bolting for the door. Holmes pursued, and I followed, the storm engulfing us as we plunged into the night. The moor was a chaos of wind and rain, fog writhing like a living entity. Alaron vanished into the mist, but Holmes pressed on, his lantern carving a dim trail through the murk. We stumbled over the drenched earth, mud clawing at our boots until we reached the orchard, a tangle of twisted trees, their branches raking the sky. In a clearing stood the masked accomplice, the ebony spear aloft, chanting in a harsh alien tongue. Alaran staggered to him, snatching the amulet from his pocket.
"Now!" he shouted. "Finish it!"
Holmes's voice rang out, clear and commanding.
"It ends here, Colonel!"
Alaran spun, his face a mask of wrath. "You're too late, Holmes. The curse is free."
Yet the accomplice faltered, his chant dissolving. Holmes advanced, unflinching.
"There is no curse, only your deceit. The spear is wood, the amulet a relic. Your poison slew Milbank, and your greed drove you to ruin."
Alaran's hands shook, the amulet falling from his grasp.
"No, it's real. I've seen it."
Holmes's tone softened, though his eyes stayed hard.
"You've seen your own delusions, Colonel. The only power here is the one you've imagined."
With a choked scream, Alaran grabbed for the spear, but the accomplice, his resolve shattered, dropped it and fled into the fog. Alaran sank to his knees, defeated, as the storm howled around us.
Chapter 6. The Light of Reason.
The storm's fury had begun to ebb by the time Sherlock Holmes and I returned to Lower Cranston, escorting a defeated and rain-soaked Colonel Alaran. The moor, though still cloaked in mist, seemed less menacing in the pale light of dawn, its oppressive weight lifting with each step we took toward the manor. Alaran, his wrists bound and his spirit broken, trudged between us in sullen silence, the manic fervor that had driven him now replaced by a hollow, haunted gaze. Inside the manor, the staff gathered in the great hall, their faces a mixture of relief and lingering fear. Mrs. Farham, her hands clasped tightly, approached with cautious hope.
"Is it over, Mr. Holmes? Is the curse truly broken?"
Holmes offered a faint, reassuring smile. "There was no curse, madam. Only the machinations of a desperate man. The ebony spear holds no power beyond that which superstition grants it."
A murmur rippled through the servants, their eyes wide with disbelief. Mr. Colby stepped forward, his voice trembling. "But the professor's death, the spear in his hand, the blood, how do you explain it?"
Holmes's gaze swept the room, his tone measured and calm. Professor Milbank's demise was not the work of a vengeful spirit, but of poison, a subtle toxin applied to the spear's tip. Colonel Alleran, driven by envy and a delusion of grandeur, sought to claim the spear's supposed power for himself. He laced the spear with a venom acquired during his travels, knowing the professor's habit of examining his relics closely. When Milbank handled the spear that fateful night, the poison entered his bloodstream through a small cut or abrasion, causing his heart to seize. I recalled the professor's unmarked body and the terror frozen on his face. But the spear, how did it end up in his grasp?
Alleran staged the scene, Holmes explained. He entered the study through a concealed passage, likely the same one we discovered beneath the manor. Once the poison took effect, he placed the spear in Milbank's hand, locking the door from within and slipping away unseen. The locked room was a ruse to fuel the legend of the curse. Mrs. Farham's brow furrowed.
And Lucy?
Why take her? Holmes's expression darkened.
Alleran believed the amulet was a key to unlocking the spear's full power, a power he thought could be invoked through a blood ritual. Lucy, as Milbank's kin, was to be his sacrifice. His accomplice, a hired rogue swayed by promises of wealth, aided him in the abduction. But their plan unraveled when we intervened. The accomplice, I'm told, was apprehended by the local constable near the village inn this morning. He'll trouble us no further.
A collective sigh of relief filled the hall, though a few servants still cast wary glances toward the artifact room.
And the spear itself? Colby asked. Is it truly harmless?
Holmes's lips twitched in a wry smile. It is a remarkable artifact, but its only curse is the one men like Alleran impose upon it. The Night Whisper tribe's legends are potent, but they hold no sway over those who do not believe.
As the staff dispersed, their steps lighter, I turned to Holmes.
You suspected Alleran from the start, didn't you?
Not from the start, he admitted, but the clues aligned swiftly. The scratched window latch, the footprints in the cellar, the amulet's significance, all pointed to a man obsessed with possession and power. His delusion merely cloaked a calculated crime.
I shook my head, marveling at his clarity.
And the chanting? The whispers in the night?
Alleran's theatrics, Holmes said dismissively. He sought to terrify the household into submission, to make them believe the curse was real. Fear, Watson, is a weapon sharper than any spear.
Later that day, as we prepared to depart Lower Cranston, Lucy approached us in the hall, her youthful face still pale but resolute.
Mr. Holmes, Dr. Watson, thank you. I mocked the curse, but I never imagined it would bring such horror.
Holmes inclined his head.
You were brave, Miss Lucy. Your uncle would be proud.
She offered a faint smile.
He always said reason was the greatest weapon against fear. I see now what he meant.
As we boarded the carriage back to the station, the moor stretched before us, its fog lifting under the morning sun. The desolate beauty of the landscape, once so foreboding, now seemed merely melancholic, its secrets laid bare. On the train to London, I turned to Holmes, still piecing together the final threads.
What of Alleran's accomplice? You mentioned his capture.
Holmes waved a hand. A minor player, swayed by greed and superstition. The constable's men found him cowering in a barn, half mad with fear. He'll face justice, but the true danger lay in Alleran's obsession, and that is extinguished. I leaned back, watching the moorland fade into the distance. It's a grim reminder, Holmes, of how far delusion can drive a man.
Indeed, he replied, his gaze distant. The human mind, when gripped by superstition, can weave curses more deadly than any poison. But reason, Watson, is the light that dispels such shadows.
Back at Baker Street, as I settled into my armchair with a brandy, the moor's chill still clung to my bones. Yet the warmth of the fire and the familiar clutter of our rooms soothed my spirit.
Holmes,
ever restless, took up his violin, drawing a slow, haunting melody from its strings. "The ebony spear will be returned to the Night Whisper tribe," he remarked, pausing mid-note, "a gesture of respect and a safeguard against future folly." I nodded, sipping my drink. "And the amulet?" "Locked away in a museum, I suspect, where it can do no harm." He resumed playing, the music filling the room with a somber grace. "The true curse, Watson, was never in the spear. It was in the hearts of those who coveted it." I raised my glass in silent agreement, the memory of the moorland shadows fading into the comfort of reason's triumph. And so, dear listeners, the fog of Lower Cranston lifts, revealing the light of reason. With his unparalleled deductive prowess, Sherlock Holmes has cut through the veil of superstition, exposing Colonel Alleron's greed and madness as the true curse that plagued the manor. The ebony spear, once feared as a harbinger of doom, is now seen for what it truly is, a mere relic, its power dispelled by the clarity of logic. As the storm subsides and the moorland shadows retreat, we leave Lower Cranston to heal, its dark secrets unearthed and its phantoms laid to rest. If this tale has captivated you, consider subscribing and leaving a comment to share your thoughts. And if you'd like to support our nocturnal tales, you can do so through our Buy Me a Coffee page. Link in the description or by becoming a patron with a YouTube membership. Until our next mystery, may the shadows whisper gently to you.